Well, this week we're getting into the weeds on invasive weeds and other invasive species. Our guests this week are Catherine Shakey from the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, Maura Schumacher from the Kenai Watershed Forum, and Marcus Mueller, the land manager for the Kenai Peninsula Borough. Over the next hour, we'll get into not just some of the problem species being dealt with, like Lodia and reed canary grass, but why those species are getting a foothold on the peninsula and what it means for the existing ecosystems. Now, let's get into the conversation. I guess just to start a program, a discussion, a conversation, if you will, about invasive species. First, if we could just maybe kind of talk a little bit about what we're seeing sort of right now today, what are the trends? What are we seeing? What are we kind of focusing our attention on right now? And maybe we'll start with you, Catherine.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I coordinate the Kenai Peninsula Cooperative Weed Management Area, and that's a partnership of federal and state agencies and nonprofits that own land and operate on the Kenai Peninsula. And a lot of what they are concerned about is managing invasive species. That partnership has been around for over 15 years now, and they've maintained a priority plant list and updated that over time. So as we've seen new invasive species get introduced, they decide which ones are the most important to tackle. And right now, we have two specific strategic management plans and best management practices that we recommend for two plants. One is Elodia, that's a freshwater aquatic invasive plant, and then the other is reed canary grass, which is a terrestrial invasive plant.
We've, at least for myself, we've done a little bit of reporting, and there's been a lot of work done, a lot of money spent to try to address the Elodia problem in local water bodies. For myself in particular, but maybe for other folks who aren't as familiar with reed canary grass, if you could talk a little bit about what that is and what it does to the landscapes that it sort of introduces itself to, and how does it even get here?
Yeah, good question. So reed canary grass is one of those plants that is... it's not native, and it was intentionally introduced originally in two ways. One, DOT was planting it for controlling erosion along the roadside because it was recommended for that, and it is good at doing that. The other was it was brought up by ranchers to feed cattle because it's a very nutritious crop and grows really well. However, we now know that it invades wetlands and salmon streams. So,
and as we were talking before we got started, it's less the actual physical presence of a plant and more the problem is what that plant tends to displace. That's the real sort of change mechanism. Is that too far off the bag?
No, that's right on. What we're concerned about is preserving biodiversity, our native ecosystems, the plants and animals that make that up. The more diverse species we have, the more resilient our ecosystems are, and we can support our local economies.
And we've got a couple of Minnesota natives here. Marcus and Maura are both from Minnesota. Catherine's from Minnesota. Okay. Everybody's from Minnesota. Go anywhere in Alaska. You're practically in Duluth. But you were mentioning, Marcus, that you, coming from that area of the world, you've seen this before, and I'm sure the rest of you can weigh in on sort of what you saw there and maybe lessons that you can bring from that.
Yeah, thank you, Shailene. So I did grow up in Minnesota, southern Minnesota, kind of the agricultural areas where it has a lot of wetlands and forest edges and a lot of croplands. And I grew up chasing around the landscape, just loved to be outdoors. And the areas that I grew up with and the places that I like to hunt and fish, as I came to know them better and what was going on, I came to understand that the wetlands were occupied by four species of plants, which is very different than how they were historically. It was all that I knew, but I grew up getting very tangled up in reed canary grass, and what I was chasing... the only reason why I was out there was because I was chasing something. And the things that I was chasing were kind of few and far between. And when I moved to Alaska 16 years ago, I was so excited to come to a place where the landscape is pristine and the biodiversity is largely intact. And I was really shocked to see reed canary grass. It's one of those things where once you know what to look for, it's fairly easy to spot, especially in October because it maintains a little bit of green past everything else. And I saw a little bit of it and started in my conversations with folks about, you know, how much of this is out there and where is it at and what does this mean? Is it gonna take root? Is it gonna take hold? Well, 16 years later, what I'm seeing is it's taken hold and it's doing what it does very well. The reason why Reed Canary is such a threat is because it's very successful. It's very successful at occupying, not just being part of the mix on the landscape, but just occupying areas. And it's not fun to walk through, and it doesn't support many things.
And Maura, if you want to jump in, maybe you could talk a little bit about your work at the Watershed Forum in terms of invasive species, perhaps more broadly, and some of the things you're seeing and just, like I said, in general, some of the work you're doing.
So I think the Kenai Watershed Forum kind of originally started looking at invasive species as we were seeing the infestations with northern pike and especially with Allodia. And as we've been kind of able to successfully tackle those problems, we've moved on to other things, terrestrial species, and we have focused in on reed canary grass because of its ability to displace other native species from streams and, yeah, most importantly, salmon habitat, because that is kind of the Watershed Forum's focus, is aquatic systems.
How does reed canary grass specifically, how does that interact with salmon habitat and why is that such a bad thing?
So not only does it displace native vegetation, but it affects the stream channel. It can increase sedimentation, which interrupts the flow of the stream and how it naturally moves through the system.
I feel like is reed canary grass sort of specifically is almost sort of poetically apt in a way, because we're talking about changes in the local ecosystem, changes in climate, and we use that term, the canary in the coal mine, as sort of an indicator of maybe what's to come. And this seems, like I said, sort of appropriate in that way, if not necessarily desirable. But is this a signifier of things? Is it okay to look at it that way?
Yeah, I can take a shot at answering that. So one thing we focus on is early detection and rapid response. It's most cost effective to tackle an invasive species as soon as it shows up. When it's a small infestation, it doesn't take a lot of effort or money or resources to get rid of that. There are, you know, when reed canary grass first showed up on the Kenai Peninsula and we realized it needed to be eradicated, it's kind of overwhelming when it's been intentionally planted everywhere. So there's a couple of cautionary tales we've been discussing behind that. One is know what you're introducing. If you're going to bring a non-native plant to the state, then do some research ahead of time, ask around. There's a lot of Cooperative Extension Service, Department of Fish and Game, local soil and water conservation districts. They have a good sense of what's a dangerous plant or animal to be introduced. The other thing is that it can be overwhelming to try to eradicate reed canary grass once it's been intentionally planted all over the peninsula. And one of the things the CWMA did is map out which watersheds are infested on the peninsula and which ones are clean, and used that as a prioritization tool to say, hey, we should direct our resources and efforts here. And if we do that and stay on it, there are places we have kept clean of reed canary grass. And there are other places where the Watershed Forum has made an effort of controlling infestations and had some success and learned a lot of lessons.
Maura, maybe you could talk a little bit about that. What are some of the, I guess, techniques for addressing this issue? And I'm sure a lot of that is dependent on precisely where you're at and what that specific area, what the goals are for that specific area.
Yes, certainly. And yeah, what stage the infestation is at, how big it is. The biggest thing that the Watershed Forum has done in the past, early on, we did experimental treatments with just digging up the plant with shovels and hauling it out and disposing of it.
That sounds very labor intensive.
Incredibly labor intensive. It was before my time here, thankfully. I would do it though if I needed to. But I think it's kind of been determined that for the rate at which it has spread on the peninsula how intact it seems to be, those methods are not going to be successful moving forward necessarily, because of the labor intensity, and it's not a sustainable practice to keep those infestations at bay.
Land management, I think, sort of as a general rule, trying to mechanize that to reach your goals is typically expensive and inefficient and works for maybe specific, very small projects. But when you're dealing with entire systems, bringing in bulldozers and shovels and pickaxes is not usually the best way to go about it. What is a good way to try to deal with this?
So, When we talk about land management and the landscapes, and as a land manager, I'm constantly looking at what our vegetation, what's going on with vegetation, because basically everything that's not within yards or streets is in the veg, and what's going on with the veg is driving so much of what we enjoy about this place and what we rely on about this place, and when we look at when we have to manage aspects of that, like you said, it's really expensive to go in and do hand or mechanical treatments to accomplish this or that. We're seeing that right now with the spruce bark beetle.
Right.
Folks that are part of those impact areas know firsthand that there's really abrupt costs to have to go in and manage to handle vegetation. When you get into the invasive situation, what that's doing is it's pulling you into managing, and there's not an escape door. Our natural intact landscapes where the veg is communities of plants that are diverse and that have this really cool forest structure and forest floor structure, places where you'll find cranberries. You don't have to really manage that. It takes care of itself. Change that. And now all of a sudden, it pulls you into managing it, and it's very costly, and it doesn't return to that state that's that takes care of itself and provides the benefits that are present in these intact landscapes.
And that's an incredibly old tale, the idea of you have a problem, so you bring in one solution. That solution creates its own problem, and so you bring in another thing to solve that problem, and now you've got two problems to deal with, and now you bring in a third solution, and a lot of times it's, you know, there's rats, so we brought in snakes, and then there's too many snakes, so we brought in cats, and blah, 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 on and on and on you go. And for me, just looking at this sort of broad scale and, you know, 10,000 foot view, it's almost like, how do you, once that chain starts, how do you stop it? How does it make sense to even stop it? And I guess the first way to do it is just to simply study and research and address and find out the scale and the scope of what's going on. Are there enough resources just to simply get the data? I mean, we're in a data-driven world, so there's always a need for more data. But I guess, you know, in sort of broad terms, where are the gaps? Maybe that's the right question. Where are the gaps in what we're trying to find out about some of these things?
Well, there are a lot of research gaps, if you ask me. I am a huge proponent of monitoring and getting baseline data so we can understand what the situation is like on the ground and make the best decisions with limited resources. I do think that when it comes to reed canary grass, there are areas where we collectively as a CWMA partnership have decided it's worth it to use herbicides to control this plant here because A, we think we can eradicate it and keep it out of this watershed. There's a solid enough native seed bank. So as Marcus was saying, that system that takes care of itself, we've seen that come back if we eradicate that plant when the infestation's small. That's really important to keep in mind for what other species might be coming down the pike that we don't know about. We know there are European green crabs in BC. Those crabs have decimated shellfish industries on the East Coast up and down it. It's just a matter of time before it shows up. Zebra mussels in the Great Lakes. There was a sailboat that was being driven through the Yukon and crossed the border into Alaska, and they've started doing inspections this year. They found one zebra mussel on that sailboat, and because of that inspection, got it off. Now, whether or not it was alive or not, you know, That's
right.
That's another thing.
But there was a point that at which you could identify if that was, yeah.
Totally. And so having those inspection points for really dangerous, injurious species that might be coming in to take over and disrupt our systems, we rely on every resident in Alaska to keep their eyes out there. So if they see something unusual, we can act on it when it's manageable. So we're not having this conversation of, oh, we have zebra mussels all over our lakes on the Kenai. How are we going to deal with it?
Right. An ounce of prevention and a pound of cure. That sort of old wives' tale. Right. Joined with Catherine Shakey is from the Homer Water and Soil Conservation District, Marcus Mueller, the Kenai Peninsula Borough Land Manager, and Maura Schumacher, Invasive Species Specialist from the Kenai Watershed Forum, all with us on this week's episode of the Kenai Conversation. In talking about sort of what the resources are to study these things, what then, again, going back to Elodia has grabbed, I think, a lot of headlines, rightfully so, over the years, because it is a huge problem. It's, I mean, it can wipe out a lake and be, that lake is nothing but Elodia and water pretty quickly, but it's really expensive to treat a lake with the herbicides that do the job that we specifically need them to do. Is there enough awareness to actually address the problem? It's one thing to have resources and be studying it. Then there's the next step. And what does that look like in actually addressing it? Are there any plans or anything sort of large scale, or is it all just sort of as part of a different study? We're looking to see if this method works, that method works.
Maybe I can jump in and then pass it over to Maura.
Yeah.
I think Elodia is a really great example of how people in this state come together to get something done collaboratively. There's a statewide working group that is sharing information and resources. And at this point, all of the known infestations of Elodia in the Mat-Su Valley and on the Kenai Peninsula have been eradicated or are currently being treated. And there is a lack of funding to buy the chemical to treat that, and there are a lot of people working on trying to get funding for that, and federal agencies have shown an interest in pooling funds together to purchase that chemical because we believe we can still eradicate it in the state.
And because that's been kind of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as I have sort of covered it a little bit, it's been a little bit case by case and piecemeal. As we see an area, maybe we can ask for a few bucks from the borough, ask for a few bucks from the refuge, and you're trying to just find partner agencies all the time, as opposed to having any sort of large-scale program, coherent program to address everything. And I don't know, do we see that as a bit of a challenge, or does it make more sense to keep things on a sort of case-by-case basis, working with, you know, this area makes sense for these agencies to address it, this area makes sense for those agencies to address it?
So one thing I'll say about that is I just was at the statewide Alaska Invasive Species Partnership Workshop in Fairbanks last week, and we have been working to create a statewide council, and there is an invasive species bill that Representative Garen Tarr will bring before the state in January. And part of that bill is to establish a statewide council that can then provide directive and coordination from the top down.
Yeah, the statewide meeting in Fairbanks, this is like the gathering of weed nerds, right? This is what this is, pretty much. Were you there too, Maura?
I was, yes, yeah, I attended.
What were some takeaways from being able to just sort of hang out with other people who are studying this in other areas of the state?
I think my biggest takeaway from the event was, yes, the room was full of people who are energetic about keeping invasive species at bay, but what really needs to be done is outreach and education. That's the most important way that we can use our tactics of early detection and rapid response in order to keep these invasive species from moving in. And a big part of my job this summer has been just going out and about and looking for Elodia. And, you know, as many of there are of us that are out there doing that, all of the Elodia infestations that have been discovered have basically been from private landowners, members of the public who happened to have the knowledge of what they were looking at, and they knew that they needed to report it. So I think just the more people in the state, members of the public that know about the problems that could be caused by these invasive species and how to identify them, the better.
Yeah, go ahead, Marcus.
I've got to say that the weed nerds that we have in the state are just a classy group of nerds. It is really incredible to see what's been done, the groundwork that's been laid by very dedicated individuals that have come together and they've built networks, and we've seen successes. I look at this, the story of Reed Canary is a cautionary tale. It's we're at a point on that one where we're going to be realizing that we're going to be accepting that on our landscape, which is a really kind of a grave place to be. But then we have Elodia, and what a huge success. This early detection and rapid response strategy, the working of a network, and these are shoestring budget kinds of networks that have come together to, in the case of Elodia, early detection, rapid response, folks that have good technical knowledge coming to the table and bringing in partners, and in some cases unlikely partners. And I'm going to say that I'm really proud of our Kenai Peninsula Borough. Shout out to my home team there, that the Kenai Peninsula Borough stepped in and was part of that effort, realizing how critically important it is for our economy in this area to get out there and do that. If Elodia was the beginning of the weed discussion, it would be past us. We would have missed it. I think that the example of Reed Canary has done a lot of network building that's really productive. This group of weed nerds, they're still shoestring. They're still under-resourced. And, I think it's important for us to figure out how we can support those efforts. And if they say that it's about learning and about what's going on and being a part of that on the individual level, then that's what I'm going to promote too.
Yeah, I'm curious. We've talked a little bit about it in terms of what a specific species, what some of the impacts for that might be in a given area. But again, sort of broadly, looking at the peninsula as a whole and the suite of challenges that it faces in terms of climate change and in terms of new species, both flora and fauna finding their way here. What are the main concerns? What are the things that we're really looking out for? Biodiversity, again, broadly has been mentioned a few times, but what's really at stake?
Yeah, I appreciate the shout out for the weed nerds because that my background is definitely in plants, but I'm also thinking about all taxa, so animals. A lot of as we're seeing changes in climate up here, it's not getting as cold as it used to. So a lot of plants and animals and insects and fungus and molds that used to die off at really extreme cold temperatures, we no longer have that buffer to protect our ecosystems up here. But also you have to think about what are the vectors? What are the ways that these species get to the state? And that is where people go, basically. So we see a lot of shipping traffic, and a lot of those ships bring water from other places and then dump that water into the ocean or they dock at a port. And then the Asian gypsy moth is one that Cooperative Extension Service just puts traps up all over the place and tries to monitor for with a very, very, very limited budget, because that is an insect that has decimated a lot. It's caused a lot of problems in other places, and it's not here yet, and it can arrive on a box that's on a boat and nobody would know. But there have been inspections done to try to prevent that. We talked about the boats coming up the highway, vehicles. So one thing that, there's a lot of uncertainty. We don't really know what might come and establish when we don't really understand what the temperature regimes are going to be moving forward. But something that is important to keep in mind is, where do you go as a recreator, as a fisherman or hunter on the Kenai Peninsula? If you are fishing on the Anchor River and you get a bunch of Reed Canary grass seeds all over your waders, wash them off before you go to the next river, because that might be a clean river. If you're ATVing somewhere that has a lot of orange hawkweed or white sweet clover, or using it up in Fairbanks where there's a bunch of bird vetch, clean it off before you bring it back to the Kenai Peninsula. So.
And so when you're at a trailhead and they have the little boot scrubbers there, those do something. Actually, please do use those, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's something we're hoping to establish a more boot brushes across the peninsula and some signage as well, just to encourage people to scrub those seeds off your boots before you get on the trail, not afterwards.
So you mentioned, and maybe we can, you mentioned a little bit about some potential legislation that Representative Garr will be introducing. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about that and other potential policy, statewide sort of policy answers that might not necessarily be on the table, but are at least being entertained, looked at, studied, those sorts of things.
Yeah, I can speak to that a little bit. So Representative Garantar she has a botany background, actually, so it's great. She really understands this issue. The invasive species bill has two components, and I should mention that it's originating from the statewide invasive species partnership, and that's a board that is elected by a group of people who have been gathering for over a decade at this annual workshop, multi-stakeholders involved. That bill has two components. One is to establish a statewide council. There's been an effort to do that for several years, and it just hasn't been able to come to fruition yet. But that would enable some of the agencies in the state to have... It would just create a stronger voice, I think, for invasive species at a higher level. And it creates the possibility of implementing... This is the second part of the bill, of implementing some... inspections, creating funding for, we would hope that there would be a funding mechanism in there for establishing quarantines when we need to. We're already seeing a little bit of that, you know, when Elodia Alexander Lake in the Mat-Su was closed off this year to fishing and float plane traffic, which was great because that means we can reduce the spread of that plant. But there's not much... You know, we don't have much teeth when it comes to making those decisions on a statewide level. I don't know, Maura, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, there are. I mean, Elodia in particular, it is illegal to transport that piece of vegetation in the state without a permit. And there are also some smaller, more local rules and regulations. I know the Anchorage municipality has made it illegal to sell European bird cherry, which is an invasive tree species. It's illegal to sell it in the municipality of Anchorage. So there's small things like that happening when problems arise that can prevent the transportation of certain things.
Is there like a master list somewhere of okay, not okay when it comes to, you know, you're at Home Depot and you're looking to do a little landscaping, you know, is there any regulation for what, you know, a big corporate store like a Home Depot, can they bring in whatever the heck they want and sell here? Is there any check or anything? I really don't know.
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a statewide noxious weed list. So there are plants that are prohibited to bring in and animals. The plants have largely been underneath the Department of DNR, and they are lacking resources. And updating those lists are really hard when you're also treating Elodia and you have, it's a lot.
It increases the workload. Well, just data entry. Again, we're getting back to this question of data, and the more you gather, the more... man hours it takes to process that data and enter it into something and, you know, be able to use it in a comprehensive and understandable way and all those things. And you are tuned to the Kenai Conversation here on KDLL as we get to the bottom of the hour. We're talking about invasive species on the Kenai Peninsula this week with Catherine Shakey from the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, Maura Schumacher from the Kenai Watershed Forum, and Kenai Peninsula Borough Land Manager Marcus Mueller. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll hear some stories from the field and what to do if you see a new kind of plant you're not too sure about. We'll be back in a few moments. Stick with us. We're getting around to the halfway point already. I wanted to get a quick story out of Marcus because as we were sort of all exchanging emails back and forth, I was tipped off to a story about you noticing something. And maybe just as a tip for people who do find themselves kind of out and about, walking around and maybe notice something a little bit different. You notice something, and then what do you do? What did you notice?
What I noticed. So I was just plinking.
Am I throwing you under the bus here a little bit? I hope
a little bit. But that's okay. Yeah, yeah. So a casual day, and I was actually in Saldana at one of the schools, and there was this beautiful little flower that was springing up from the cracks in the sidewalk, and I went down to look at it, and it was kind of curious because I hadn't really seen anything like it, and as I got closer, it was really kind of an angry looking plant, and I think it even has a name that's kind of angry. Catherine, help me out. What was it called?
It's an invasive nightshade, which is in the potato family. And I can't remember what it's called.
It had spines on it that were like a turkey leg. So, you know, the spurs on a turkey leg? Yeah. Like that.
It's a solanum. That's the genus. So,
but looking pretty gnarly.
It was looking really gnarly. It was happy there. It was plenty happy in the cracks. And so I snapped a picture of it. It was something that I hadn't recognized, and I happened to be aware that there was folks that were in this business. There were weed nerds out there, so I sent the picture to the weed nerds, and they came back with a description that I was able to look up then online and chase this plant down and see what it was. And yeah, it's something that I don't want to see again. It was interesting, but boy, it wasn't something that I want living in my neighborhood.
Right.
And we maintain a statewide, the University of Alaska, Alaska Center for Conservation Science, maintains a clearinghouse of exotic plants that are found. And so if you do find a plant like that, just like Marcus did, it's great to contact someone. It's even better if you can get a sample of that plant. We can get it pressed, and we can collect that data and add it to our database so that we keep track of what's showing up where.
And again, that database growing all the time, but maybe not necessarily, I don't know, is it growing as fast as you would like, or does a quick growing database of newly introduced species mean not a good thing, even if you do have the capacity to keep up with it?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I think, you know, more information and data is definitely always helpful and useful, and managing that data is a constant conversation in many fields. We are limited with the clearinghouse in that it's only public lands that we can record information on. So, you know, Moore and I have our own systems throughout the summer and how we track which plants are being treated and managed and when we come up with new ones. So I think it speaks to the importance of having local regional partnerships, so you can keep tabs on what's happening on the Kenai Peninsula, and then you can scale that up to what's happening across the state.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Cooperative Weed Management Group a bit earlier, and I wanted to talk, ask Catherine and Maura both about some of the different partnerships and if that, you know, how could that be streamlined? How could that all work better? Because it is, when you start digging into it, you're, as you said, Marcus, it's a lot of small organizations, don't have huge budgets, don't have huge staffs, and everybody's just kind of trying to do what they can. What would a perfect system look like in terms of coordinating those efforts, gathering that information, and then being able to do something with that information?
I think we've got a good start with what we have set up at the CWMA, to be honest. It kind of gets all interested parties in the same room, conversing about the same problems, and it's a great way to express where you need help, whether it's with extra personnel to work on some project, or we need funding for another project. And it's also been great because, you know, there are big landowners represented, like the Forest Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service. So it's been a great way to exchange ideas and resources.
Are there, I don't want to necessarily, you know, black flag any one particular group, but are all the organizations and managing partners that ought to be involved in these discussions, are they all at the table?
Yeah, two things about that. One, the Kenai Peninsula CWMA is the shining example for the state. There are a lot of other regions that wish they had what we have here. I think I've been in this position just over a year, and it's clear to me that there's been a history of passionate individuals in positions in state and federal agencies that have pooled together to keep meeting here. The origins of the CWMA came from Homer Soil and Water and Kenai Soil and Water, and then also state and private forestry. But I do think what we're missing are more large-scale private landowners in our group. So that's something we're working on this winter, inviting HEA, Chugach Electric, Native Corporation landowners, really to the table to have more conversation. Because to take it back to reed canary grass, the Russian River is a site where we have been treating and controlling reed canary grass there for years, and the folks on the ground spraying there still think we can eradicate it. If we didn't control it, it will change that landscape. There is a power line that runs adjacent to that area, and it's infested with reed canary grass. And so we will be working together, hopefully, to see and decide what can be done. And this circles back to having a statewide council. If we have a statewide council, then it would be great to see some directive come to and funding for DOT to treat their roadways, to support some of the larger infestations and collaborative efforts.
I'd like to take the time, too, to compare this to our friends in the counties in the lower 48, most of which have on the municipal or on the county level a weed commission. They have a whole department and program that with salaried positions where a lot of times their whole job is to go and spray ditches and manage laws, regulations affecting private property owners about them taking required actions on their property. They're so far beyond where we're at right now, but the history is one where it becomes an economic necessity. These things don't spring up because they're fun to do. They spring up because they're necessary to do. And we at the Kenai Peninsula Borough and in the state of Alaska, we don't have a municipal weed commission. We have a cooperative weed management area made up by a bunch of passionate folks that are working using the resources that they have, the networks that they have, and the tools that they have. But doing that largely on a ad hoc basis and making things work as well as possible with lots of challenges. It's really you don't realize how big our landscape is until you take on some of these issues about weed populations and how things move around and how you'll have an invader that can get picked up on the tires of a four-wheeler and move a mile into the woods. They're big issues for us.
And I'm glad you brought up sort of, you know, what they're doing in other places around the country, because so often we take a lot of pride in being Alaskans and we do things differently here, and it's not the lower 48, but at the same time, when it comes to issues like this or, you know, habitat issues for salmon, they're being in Alaska also affords that opportunity to sort of see things coming because, you know, other places have had to deal with it. So what's worked, what hasn't worked. And so there can be a lot of lessons in a huge variety of areas of study about sort of what to do, what not to do, what works, what doesn't work, for sure. Marcus, I wanted to stick with you for a second, because as we're talking about these potentially big landscape changes as a land manager, the type of landscape you're managing, that opens up a whole lot of different questions. If we're talking about potentially losing a significant portion of spruce trees over the next, you know, X amount of years, and if there's also a potential for those trees to not come back, or at least come back in the same numbers that they were here originally, now we're looking at land in a different way, because it's there's different stuff on it, there's different use potentials for it. What are things that you're looking at sort of long term at this point? Or maybe the better question is, how long term can you look at some of these things?
Thank you, Sharon. So just to kind of paint this picture a little bit, there's been some great work that's come out of the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, where they've looked at our plant communities, kind of our ecotones that have to do with what is our climate here and what is the vegetation types that supports. And so as we know it here across a lot of the Kenai Peninsula, we're in a white spruce or Lutz spruce forest. We have mixed forest where you've got a birch or aspen component mixed in with the white spruce, and then you've got black spruce swamps. And as we've seen, so some of the work that's come out of the refuge is that they've shown that we're kind of right on the edge of that that boreal forest. And if you take and bring the precipitation down just a little bit, or take and bring the temperature up just a little bit, and kind of just change that available water balance, you move from a spruce boreal forest into a grassland. Vastly different vegetation type. And it's actually the vegetation type that I've heard is what Captain Cook encountered as he came through. Some of the things that's interesting about that is that on the Kenai Peninsula, we happen to not have a grass grazer. We have got moose that likes to browse, but where's our grass grazer, the type of critter that goes through and likes to eat grass and turn that material over? Because that's what makes a healthy grassland is that recycling of the materials. Otherwise, if you don't have recycling, it's what they call rank. You get a rank grassland, which is not productive. And so looking at those types of changes, and what that means. So we just came off of a big fire year, and how does fire move across the spruce forest? How does fire move across the grassland? Well, California with its scrub type of environment. Now they've got Chinook winds that they're dealing with, or Santa Ana winds. I'm sorry, but they've got also a fine fuel type that's not unlike grasslands where it can carry fire in a much more rapid rate across the landscape. So we're looking at these things. You know, of course, it's more questions than answers. We haven't been through it. But there's lots of questions to be had and changes that we're looking at that need to have conversations around them.
Could I jump in there? So related to the fire events on the Kenai, you know, invasive species, invasive plants take root in recently disturbed areas. And so we're really going to be concerned about the next couple of years and watching those burned areas and monitoring. And certainly we need resources to monitor those areas for new infestations. But the other thing I wanted to mention, Marcus, as you were talking, I was thinking about how, you know, we often take for granted, especially if you've been living in Alaska a while, you take for granted the pristine areas we have here for recreating in and living and that support our local economies, our fisheries, our salmon. And we need to be conscientious of how we interact with that landscape because especially as there are these uncertainties around what our climate is going to do and we're getting more invasive, we are more vulnerable to invasive species more than we have ever been. And so we need to be stewards of the landscape that we play and live and work on. And that means paying attention. And then if you see something that doesn't look right, acting on that or encouraging other people to clean their equipment, clean their boats. Don't dump your aquarium in a lake because that's how most of our Allodia infestations have started.
Right, right. Yeah, and from the water perspective, and I'll direct this at you more of kind of a slightly more watershed forumy kind of a salmon question. When we're looking again at these potentially broad changes, there's a lot of work that has to be done to maintain those areas around salmon habitat, sort of as it is. We know salmon are such a sort of a marginal species, as we mentioned. You know, a little change here or there can drastically change things. What are some of the things that you're keeping an eye on in terms of the salmon habitat and some of these changes? Is it, I mean, Allodia, obviously, we know what that does in the water, but other things sort of on the land, because I think people sort of don't give a whole lot of credit to what the landscape means for in-river habitat for fish.
Yeah.
So what are you paying attention to out there?
Sure. I mean, it's all connected, whether, you know, something is terrestrial or growing in the water system. So we're kind of keeping an eye on other potential species that could work their way into our water systems, one of those being white sweet clover. If you drive up the Seward Highway and you get past Girdwood, that's what you're going to see alongside of the road. Down here on the Kenai Peninsula, you will hardly see any at all. So that's one of the things we're kind of keeping our eyes on. as far as the land goes. We are also still very interested in, again, the breed canary grass question. I think with our increase in temperature, our longer summers, I think we're going to see that species really expand, and it is going to be a very happy place for reed canary grass in the future. So, yeah, our plan is to continue to keep tabs on the spread of reed canary grass throughout the peninsula.
And I wanted to get to, it's been integrated into some of the talk as we've gone through the most of this hour now, but specifically, you know, who's the number to call? Who are the people that can help you identify things? How do people who maybe don't walk around with a plant notebook in their hand all the time, but do notice something weirdly, where do you go? How do you file these things away? Who do you tell, and what do you tell them?
We have a couple of options depending on the mode of communication you prefer. So,
if you want pictures are good, right?
That's right. Yeah, pictures are very helpful. If you see any type of invasive species, fish, plant, mussels, whatever, you can just call a phone number. That's 1-877 invasive. Kind of nifty. But the number of that is 1-877-468-2748. That usually goes to Department of Fish and Game. You can also contact your local cooperative extension service, snap a picture, send it to them, your local soil and water conservation district. You can contact the watershed forum. You can just call Fish and Game. You can, you know, John Morton has been the Elodia go-to person for a lot of folks, and that works great. But he's, you know, going to be retiring at some point soon, and we need to make sure that, you know, people have that it's easy for them. If you don't know where to go and you'd rather just go to a website, kenaiweeds.org is our CWMA website, and we have links to those other resources there. If you want to inch towards the weed nerd status, you can get the Alaska Weeds ID app. And that,
there's an app for
there
that?
There is an app, and that's something Cooperative Extension Service created. It's great. I use it, and you can. It's got a key in there, but it also has a data upload function, so you can take a picture of it, and then it also takes a GPS point, and then you can upload it, and you do have to sign up for it, but that goes directly to Gino Graziano at Cooperative Extension Service. And then it gets uploaded into that statewide database. So it's pretty slick.
So there are a lot of options in terms of being able to interact with the many, many cooperating agencies who are, all of you, trying to just keep an eye on this for now and figure out sort of plans. I don't know, is plans of attack, is that too, is that too strong a term for addressing some of this stuff?
That's the perfect term, plan of attack.
Maura's been leading several weed warrior community events this summer, too. So thank you for that.
Tell us about some of those.
Yeah, I had some volunteers come out with me on several occasions. The CWMA organized a weed pull in Seward. We also had one up in Hope. We were pulling white sweet clover. I had a group of YCCers out with me in Sterling pulling bird vetch. And that we also had a weed pull in Kenai. So we definitely want to continue promoting and having these events. They're great for people to learn about what species they should be looking for, what to plant in their gardens, who to talk to about these issues. So, yeah.
And As we're sitting here talking, all of us sort of patiently awaiting winter, and we've spoken about it a little bit before, but again, this idea of a gradual changing of what it is to be winter on the Kenai Peninsula, at least, it's changing a little bit, and so. I had somewhere I was going with this with snow cover that was in my mind. But those are, I guess, the continuously changing conditions are always a consideration because, as you mentioned, it keeps that door open a lot wider for stuff to make its way up here and get a foothold, whereas you could usually count on a week or two of 20, 30 below to wipe anything out that wasn't supposed to, quote-unquote, supposed to be here. Maybe can't count on those extraordinarily frigid temperatures for extended periods that are going to make sure next year's crop of whatever it is doesn't get a foothold.
Yeah, and I would add on that several of our flowering invasive plants have had second flushes in these longer summers. Orange hawkweed has been seen flowering multiple times, and That is disconcerting. Also, you know, reed canary grass, its rhizomes, the underground roots, can grow 9 feet in one season. If you give it a longer season, it will go even further. So, and while I'm thinking of it, I did just want to put a shout out, a huge thank you to the Chugach National Forest and Fish and Wildlife Service and the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, because they've been very active in not only monitoring and treating invasive species on their public lands, but also on the boundaries and putting resources towards treating along the Seward and Sterling highways, when really that's the, you know, state's land, but they're chipping in.
You know, we've spent a lot of time, and I think rightfully so, talking about what potential negative consequences there could be if some of these changes are left sort of unchecked. And that's mostly been in terms of trying to maintain what we know about this place and, you know, salmon habitat and all these sorts of things. I have to wonder, though, if there aren't potentially, as again, broad terms and a changing climate, if there aren't potentially some winters out there. And I'm thinking specifically of this summer. I know was a really good year for folks who had bees, and the bees did fantastic. There was a very short window where they were able to get to the fireweed and they got a lot of it. But, you know, I wonder if that also doesn't open up the opportunity for maybe there's more flowers for bees and our bees will be a little bit happier here. I don't want to downplay the serious consequences of what's coming our way and the really hard problems that we're going to have to address to maintain some of these things. But at the same time, you know, maybe the bees might be a little bit happier. Are there opportunities, or maybe that's not really even the right way to look at it. I'm not sure.
Spruce Bark Beetle certainly likes these nice warm summers that we've been having.
Yes, that's right.
They're doing great. and you know, as we look towards you know, warmer winters and warmer summers, you know, that we're going to see a lot of more variation in what does well, more extremes, and there are going to be some plants that do really well. Some of them will be invasives that we don't like, and then there's going to be things like fruit trees that all of a sudden we open up some climate space for, and so there's, you know, certainly our folks that are into gardening, into really watching what does well and to make plant selection choices that are using our warmer long daylight. There will be some winters there. It's going to be a little bit hard to predict what all comes out of these changes, but I think you're right. I think that there's going to be some interesting opportunities, interesting changes that are in our future.
And it's about promoting biodiversity. That's what invasive species are about, really. You don't want monocultures or one single species in a lake. So,
and you kind of answered my last question before I had a chance to ask it, which was, you know, we spent a lot of time this hour talking about a lot of things, but at the core of it, I feel like there's kind of a central message here, and it's about biodiversity and the importance of that. Is that maybe getting away from the specifics of any given species of invasive? Is that maybe more the message that you try to promote, or is it really more awareness of those invasives, or a combination thereof, I'm sure.
Well, that's what I think a lot about as I'm managing a CWMA and thinking about outreach and how we do that in the midst of a changing climate. And there's a lot of conversation happening in the professional realm about that too. One really valuable tool that we have is an invasiveness ranking. So UAA maintains that, and I use that all the time. I'm not worried about certain plants because they're ranked low. And so some plants are ranked high. Allodia is ranked really high. One thing we did see this summer is the first Allodia flower ever. And that is dangerous because that means if that plant can sexually reproduce, then it's going to get harder to eradicate it. Right now, it's still cloning itself.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, we have, you know, just a couple minutes left. So, you know, does anyone have parting thoughts on, you know, actions? We've talked about, you know, actions the public can take and things to be aware of, but just sort of on the way out.
I guess I would just say, you know, as a private landowner, if something jumps your fence that you planted, tell somebody about it before it gets too far down the road or down the creek. If you're wondering that if you have an invasive plant, get in touch with one of us. And again, that early detection is key. And it is about understanding your ecosystem, and the baseline data is important so that in a lot of uncertainty and climate, we know how to effectively manage.
A parting message that I would like to give, if it hasn't been evident already, is that weed nerds care. These folks that I get a chance to meet with, I go to these cooperative weed management area meetings on occasion, and I'm more of a user than a giver. These folks are coming together with and bringing their expertise and putting a lot of research in, and a lot of figuring how to take and come up with strategies that would be effective. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to keep this place intact for all of us. And so I really, really just want to say that weed nerds are good people, and they care about our neighborhoods, and I appreciate that.
Final thoughts from me. I'm going to say we need your help out there. There are plenty of watersheds out there that have not been touched by reed canary grass. We want to keep them that way. Clean your equipment. If you see something that's out of place, I know we've said this, but if you see something out of place, tell someone so that we can act on it quickly and efficiently.